This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And here is CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. So this job crunch we keep hearing about, is this because of young workers spoiled by their generous unemployment benefits or older workers who've decided they've just had enough and they're going to retire?
Yes and yes. I don't want to say the spoiled part. Listen, there are some fascinating dynamics playing out in the labor market, and it's really been interesting to watch. And I actually keep thinking about the fact that if we go back a year ago, to imagine that we would be talking about consumer spending, the economy growing, businesses reopening, you know, lots of people vaccinated, we would have taken that deal in about 2 seconds, right? So it's, we are in way better shape than we thought we would be at this point. So that's the good news. The bad news is that it's become clear that it's a heck of a lot easier to freeze and lock down an economy than it has been to defrost it. And, you know, sometimes when I defrost meat, it gets kind of sloppy and it's... You hear that the dogs don't like it, that's for sure. Sometimes when I defrost a piece of meat, it gets a little sloppy, it gets a little gooky. And you know what happens? You have to make an adjustment. And that's what's happening right now in the labor market. We're making adjustments. Clearly, there are people who are staying home, collecting unemployment benefits, and reconsidering their next steps. But there are also some pretty severe issues around childcare that have had to been worked out. We know that there are folks who stayed home, about 20% of workers were staying home or cut their hours simply because of childcare. And a lot of those folks were at the lower end of the income earners, and they are probably just starting to wade back into the labor force, and they will continue to do so. But I think that there are a lot of people who retired and said, I've had enough, or I'm exhausted, or I need to reconsider the way I work. And these are the people, I think, that are going to determine kind of how things move forward in this next iteration. It is not the employers that have the big problems in many respects. It's the employees who will tell the employers exactly what those problems are. And let's see how it does shake out. I think that the actual labor shortage itself is probably a little overstated, because really, if it's such a shortage, just pay more.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Maybe have they tried that yet? Just raising the wages to see if that works?
Some of them have. OK, there has been some wage increase. There's been about a 2% increase from a year ago. But, you know, it may not just be wages. I keep thinking about this. If I was a person who had worked in a restaurant and I had inconsistent hours, because restaurants are notorious for, you know, making schedules the week before, right? So I have an inconsistent schedule. Maybe I don't get health benefits. And on my hourly wage, let's call it, you know, is $15 an hour. Maybe I'm lucky enough to work in a nice restaurant. I get $15 an hour. Now I'm my employer says, come on back, I'm ready to go. And I say, well, you know, interestingly, I can go work in a warehouse with benefits, with set hours, and I can get paid $18, $19, $20 an hour. So my love of restaurants only goes so far. Thank you very much. Goodbye. And so in that case, what has to happen is that employers, the restaurant, has to figure out, what is it that I can do to make these people's lives better? I can pay them more. Well, if I pay them more, I go out of business, which is what I got an email from someone who said this to me recently. And I said, well, unfortunately for you, that might mean you don't have a business that can be sustainable in this iteration of the economy.
I would think that with all the extra money people have sloshing around and how desperate they are to get out, that they would tolerate higher menu prices, don't you think?
I do. I think that they will in the short term. But, you know, this is all a really interesting evolution also, because we know for years businesses and big employers especially held a lot of the power in the relationship, right?
Yeah.
What's happening that's really fascinating is that workers are now demanding more and getting it. And it's not because there's a huge unionized effort. It's because the laws of supply and demand are creating power for the worker. And so I think that there are some workers who say, hey, you know what? I learned in the pandemic, I don't really want to work 5 days a week in an office. I want to telecommute. I want to have, you know, 1 day or 2 days. I'm going to find a job that allows me to do that. You know, here in the New York metropolitan area, we have all the big banks run by, you know, sort of these swaggering guys. There's one woman, but I'll call them swaggering guys, who are all like, oh no, everyone must be in the office by, you know, June 30th, right? And they're saying this. Well, if I work at one of those banks, how about if I say, you know what? I don't need to be in a place where I'm just, I have to be in because it just looks better. That's ridiculous. We're also hearing great and important changes in large companies that are saying, we always said that you needed a college degree for this job. What they've now said is, well, maybe you don't need a college degree. Maybe we'll cast our net wider. And that's going to be a really good thing for workers also.
So you're saying this is a refreshing change. And that it happened without unions is something that I guess the employers were not expecting.
I don't think anyone was expecting this. I think that it's been a really interesting and dynamic time for me, at least. I don't recall a time in my life being either part of the economy as a business owner or covering it where we've seen such a dramatic shift in such a short period of time. For decades, we've talked about how the employers control relationships. And it is kind of neat in every kind of market to see a shift occur. It is happening quite quickly. And look, maybe we're wrong. Maybe this will all go back to the way it was. This is what all the guys on Wall Street keep saying to me. Oh, no, it'll go back. You'll see. You'll see. I'm not so sure.
One more thing, which has nothing to do with this. But I noticed a few weeks ago that Joe Biden officially said, we have no interest in buying Greenland. Now, Trump had brought this up. I think it's a mistake because the way climate change is working, Greenland will be the new temperate climate. And they also said it was stupid to buy Alaska back in the day. Don't you think the Greenland deal should be reconsidered?
Let me just say this about that. I don't want to talk about Greenland. I know nothing about Greenland. But I will tell you what my grandfather, Papi Julian, used to say at every Passover Seder.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Take this to the bank, okay, my friends?
Okay.
There's a part of the Passover Seder which talks about the exodus of Jews, and it talks about how we went in one direction, you know, 40 years and miles, we went this direction. And my grandfather used to say, if they just went in that other direction, we would be sitting on top of the oil. Let me ask you this. Are
yes.
you the kind of guy who's into the space thing?
Oh, yeah.
So it's sort of a similar thing, right? Like, let's go explore and go to other places. I have no adventure in me. I feel like getting, you know, crossing, you know, a big avenue in New York City is enough risk that I can take every day.
What do you think about Jeff Bezos getting in one of his own rockets, huh?
Good luck. I mean, yeah. I'm going to interview Richard Branson tomorrow night.
Uh-huh.
And he is like Mr. Adventurer. You know, he's like almost died in doing all these things. I know that I just don't have that in me. I think life is like plenty of adventure here on Earth. There's so much adventure every day.
CBS Senior Business Analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
Take care.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Nick Allard has been complaining since the first blossoms of spring that the pollen this year is out of control. So let's see what the doctor has to say about allergies.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. And I hear that you are also a pollen victim yourself.
I am. Nick has it exactly right. It turns out that this year is one of the worst hay fever or seasonal allergy seasons in quite a long time. So people who are sensitive to it, they sure know it when the season is bad.
So what is an allergy exactly?
You know, when we call it a seasonal allergy, it's one that happens around this time of year. It's commonly known as hay fever, but really it's an allergic rhinitis. It means that we get stuffiness and runny nose and a lot of inflammatory symptoms in our body as a result of really the pollen, the environmental dust that's in the air, and it causes us to have a lot of discomfort.
Now, do we know why some people are allergic and others are just not?
I think it's a good question, and I don't think there's really a good explanation. There certainly is some familial component to it. So if you have a parent who is susceptible to allergies, you're more likely to get allergies as well. But, you know, there are things that can be done. So people who suffer from bad seasonal allergies could actually go to an immunologist, an allergist, who can treat them for it. And so you can actually get desensitized to the things that you're allergic to.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd actually go into an allergist's office and they would do skin testing. They would take all the local allergens and prick your skin with them and see what you react to.
Right.
And then once they figure out what you react to, they'll create a serum and then they'll inject that serum subcutaneously underneath your skin, you know, a couple times a week for many years, actually, so that you become tolerant to and desensitized to the allergen itself with constant exposure. It's sort of like
the hair of the dog.
Yeah. It's sort of like the vaccination, if you will, to these other allergens. It's just another way of getting our immune system to protect us in our sort of hostile environment. I think one of the most interesting challenges about it is this, which is that you get tested in the allergist's office for what's local. Whatever plants we have locally in Washington, you'll get tested for. And then they, in their office or in their lab, will make up the serum that you get tested for. But then if you pack up and you move to, you know, Nashville, Tennessee, and they have an entirely different plant profile, you could end up having allergies there that you were never desensitized to because it wasn't local in Washington. So it is possible to get desensitized in one location, show up in a new location, and then have new allergies.
So now that we all have masks, can you prevent, I mean, the pollen particles are much larger than viral particles. Your mask would conceivably protect you from that.
It's interesting that you bring that up because people actually with allergies have been wearing masks for years. The difference is in the past, when you wore a mask during the allergy season, you sort of stood out as being different. Whereas now it's very easy to always wear a mask. But yeah, absolutely. If you can wear a mask, you can protect yourself. I mean, the way that we mostly get the symptoms from it is by breathing it in. It's by taking it in through our nose and our mouth and into our lungs. And it's a systemic, meaning a whole body response. We release this histamine chemical that causes a lot of these symptoms. And it's all part of this inflammatory response to the allergen. So wearing a mask is quite comfortable to do now, or in the past it wasn't. But if you get symptoms, there are a number of different treatments, largely over the counter now. So, you know, we can take over the counter antihistamines, and those block the action of histamine, the chemical that is largely responsible for the symptomatology. If you have a runny nose, you can take a decongestant to help dry it up. And if you have more, you know, severe symptoms and more of a severe reaction, and an oral antihistamine doesn't work well enough, you can take steroid inhalers. Those have to be prescribed to you. But you can take steroid nasal spray. That used to be prescription, but now you can actually get it over the counter. And in people who are most severe, you may have to take oral steroids, or in some cases, people get injections of steroids. Things like nasal irrigation using a neti pot can be helpful. And I find one of the most helpful things of all is controlling your environment. Use a HEPA filter to filter the air in your home, to filter the air in your car, to filter the air in your workplace. That can make a huge difference, because one of the problems is once you get sort of inflamed and you start to be symptomatic, going into a clean environment that's free of pollen isn't going to make you better right away. Your immune system has to sort of calm down. It can take a few hours. But, you know, if you stay in an environment like that, you can feel quite good. And actually, now that we're filtering airplanes, filtering the air every 2 minutes, you know, airplanes are actually quite a good place to be to not be experiencing pollen.
Yeah. I think I'd just wear a mask. It would have a message across the front saying, I'm not trying to shame you. I'm just allergic.
Yeah, you could do that. The thing is, oftentimes a mask alone isn't enough because people tend to be really sensitive. Even just getting pollen in your eyes can cause you to have an entire body systemic response. So it's sort of hard to completely protect it. You can help, but usually it requires a combination of things to really get control over it.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thanks very much.
Thanks, Dave.
King County judge recently handed Seattle a victory in the long battle to tax big business. And with the story, here is Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Seattle could finally get its tax on big business. It's a long-sought endeavor. You might remember in 2018, the Seattle City Council pushed through the head tax, but almost immediately had to repeal it after...
No head tax! No head tax! No head tax! No head tax!
Significant pushback from some in the business community. But as COVID slammed the region, upending the economy and hundreds of thousands lost jobs, and homelessness got even worse... The new city council took a stab at passing a tax on big business last year, and they did just that in July on a 7-2 vote, approving the so-called jumpstart tax. not a head tax, but a payroll tax on businesses with at least $7 million a year in annual payroll. Those companies would pay a graduated rate of between 0.7% and 2.4% on the earnings of every employee earning $150,000 a year or more. The top tier targets the top of the pack, companies like Amazon, with at least $1 billion in annual payroll that would be hit with that 2.4%, while businesses with 7 to 8 million in payroll would pay the lower rate. This tax expected to generate more than $200 million a year to help fund affordable housing, community development, some local business assistance, and the Green New Deal investments, among other things. As it passed last summer, advocates cheering the step toward getting big business to finally pay its fair share.
We know how important it is to stop the gentrification that's happening. Okay, our work is not done, but hey, you started the vision. You will complete the vision.
This will be a historic victory for not only Seattle's working people, but for working people nationwide.
But local business owners that spoke to Cairo 7 warned.
Now, we have a city council that is creating chaos in a time where we are struggling so much.
And that downtown spa owner was worried.
We're such an ecosystem, and it's going to cause such a trickle-down effect, and it, you know, all of the employees from all these businesses, they trickle down to all the restaurants and boutiques, and it's just going to have a devastating effect on all the small businesses.
But supporters like Shama Sawant argue
the tax will fund massive amounts of affordable housing every year. While the affordable housing has to be built, who will build it? We're going to have thousands of workers who will get living wage jobs. And who will benefit? It's going to be the community around them, including local businesses.
And sponsor Teresa Mosqueda explaining last week.
It is on only the largest businesses and only on the largest salaries. For those largest companies who've done well and sometimes done better during COVID, that they pay a small assessment towards helping to make sure folks have housing, equitable development, and investments in Green New Deal and a resilient economy.
Still, as we emerge from the COVID pandemic, many worry about the impact to already struggling businesses. Those concerns are among the reasons the Seattle Metro Chamber of Commerce sued the city over the jumpstart tax.
We want to work with the city on economic recovery and transportation and homelessness and generating tourism and supporting arts and culture and all of those things that we've been talking about. But the other reality is that when we're talking about something that is illegal, like a tax like this, we will bring a lawsuit on behalf of our members.
CEO Rachel Smith had this to say about their reasoning behind the lawsuit last week.
It's true that when there are, you know, serious conversations about policy and revenue, the employers of this community want to be at the table. We stand ready to collaborate with the city leaders on good policy, and we encourage them to take a different approach than the one that sort of resulted in this legal challenge. And going forward for us, we feel like it is time to collaborate on legal and practical solutions that result in a change of outcomes and invest in a long-term sustainable recovery plan for our city and our residents.
In its lawsuit, the chamber calling the tax illegal, invalid, and unenforceable. Roberts saying in her ruling that it was not, in fact, an illegal tax that employees had to pay, but rather a permissible excise tax the city is allowed to charge companies for the privilege of doing business here, green-lighting the tax to move forward, with it due to be collected starting in January. City Attorney Pete Holmes saying in a statement after the ruling, our success in this lawsuit was never in doubt considering the legislature's express authorization to impose a progressive tax like this. He added that the COVID-induced recession has only deepened existing inequalities, and the jumpstart tax revenues are essential to housing the unsheltered and preventing people from losing their homes in the first place. As for the chamber, they say they're mulling over their legal options because they could appeal with an eye towards possibly the state Supreme Court. If this tax does survive the legal challenge, again, it would kick in January. And it may not be the last we hear about such a tax, with some state lawmakers already eyeing a possible statewide model last session, where they push pause due to time constraints and concern about double dipping.
Car Radio's Hannah Scott.
Heritage Homecraft is your sponsor of the Daily Dose of Kindness, and I'm going to dedicate this one to Sully and his wife Holly on their 24th wedding anniversary today.
How did you find out about that?
Well,
24 years. Holy cow.
I know. He posted a picture of their wedding, a sharp-looking Sully and his beautiful wife. So this story is an update to a story about love, no matter the obstacles.
For 95-year-old John Schultz,
stand right here.
The best thing to come out of this pandemic is coming down the aisle. John's brand new bride, Joy Morrow Knowlton, is also 95. And together they're proving you're never too old to make a lifetime commitment.
Until death do us part.
We first met John and Joy in March, parked along the banks of the Hudson River in Kingston, New York. Parked in the slang sense.
Wait a minute, getting your glasses up.
Fortunately, their PDA...
That's it.
...is mostly...
For the week.
LOL.
He's a lot of baloney.
John and Joy were each widowed, twice, but determined to find love again, which wasn't easy. Before getting vaccinated, they had to do most of their dating in a bubble.
She was worth it. It was a pain in the neck, though.
Perseverance.
Pete Schultz is John's son.
They would call every day. They'd find a way to get together, but they did whatever it took.
You haven't held hands with me all day, by the way.
Hold my hand.
What it took, they say, was a return to simple pleasures, like long drives to nowhere, batting balloons around the house, and a whole lot of selflessness.
She bought me a walker.
She bought you a walker?
$159, I think.
Whoa.
I told you she had money. She did have it, so she bought my walker.
Not to be outdone, John bought her a little something, too.
I declare you husband and wife.
For many of us, June weddings will mark a reemergence.
You may kiss your bride.
A bright bloom after a dark winter and a proclamation that young love is officially out of lockdown. Steve Hartman on the road near Kingston, New York.
Now, joining us from the G and Ursula show, which begins at 9 here on Cairo Radio, here's G Scott. We were talking last week about the Julio Jones situation and whether he was going to play for the Seahawks, and he will not be playing for the Seahawks, as you correctly predicted. But who's he signing with, and is this good news or bad news?
This is for the Tennessee Titans. Well, first of all, it's great news that he did not sign with the Seahawks. I'll get to that in a second. He signed with the Tennessee Titans. The Tennessee Titans traded to get him. They gave up to the Atlanta Falcons a 2022 second-round pick and a 2023 fourth-round pick for Julio Jones. Oh, and they have to pay all of Julio Jones' salary. Right.
Which
now,
is
Julio,
what?
Julio Jones is due to make $15.3 million base salary this year. He's due to make $21 million the next season after that. Right now, the Titans are a little over the salary cap. They're about $3.4 million over the salary cap. So they were going to already have to make a few moves in order to kind of get close to that. Well, now they're going to have to really make some moves to be able to take care of that $15.3 million for Julio Jones. So there's some people that's at Tennessee Titans like, oh boy, I better work hard because I might be getting cut to make room for Julio Jones. Now, why is that good news for Seattle?
Yes.
Would have been cool to have a wide receiver like that. That wasn't the problem. The asking price was too much, number one. And number two, Seahawks don't want to be giving up that kind of draft capital, and the Seahawks definitely don't want to be paying that type of salary to a football player, which I'm not going to lie, he's a good football player, but he's 32 years old, right? He's 32 years old, and I know that sounds, and then he's coming off of some injuries as of just recently. And I'm not saying he's not going to be a good player, but if he would have come over, maybe Seahawks give a couple draft picks, maybe Atlanta, you guys pay half his salary, but the Seahawks have other things to take care of, right, than that. It's kind of like, you know, getting some work done in your kitchen, right? You're like, well, do I really need new cabinets, or can I just paint over them?
But is he going to cause trouble as an opponent to the Hawks?
He's in the AFC, so, but the Seahawks do play them. I think they play them the second game of the season, but he's in the AFC, so it's not like he got traded to an NFC, like the 49ers or the Arizona Cardinals or the LA Rams.
So, G, I'm almost afraid to ask, but what did you do to get blocked by Brett Favre? Is it Favre?
Brett Favre?
I just remember, what was the movie where the person was like, Brett Favre? I thought that was Tommy Boy, but...
Something About Mary.
Something About Mary. Yes, that's right. So, Brett Favre, he blocked you on Twitter. What'd you do, G?
Yeah, he blocked me. Well, Naomi Osaka, and you guys know she's the tennis player that withdrew from the French Open because of mental health issues. Mm-hmm. Well, here's what he said on his podcast, quote, "We should talk to the media. I'm not saying you have to. You chose to be fined or not. I do think athletes are held to a different level and a different standard, and rightfully so, because of the money that we make."
What?
So that's fine. That's fine. It's cool. All I did was say, when you're talking about the standard, because you make a lot of money, does that standard include when you sent a nasty text message with a picture of your you-know-what back in 2008 to that media member? Does that count that? Or does that count when you have yet to still repay the $600,000 of the promised $1.1 million in welfare money that you took from the state of Mississippi? Does that count that? Yeah, he blocked me.
Now, what's the difference between being blocked and unfollowed?
Well, unfollowed just means that they don't show up on your timeline. Blocked means that they can't see you and you can't see them. You are shut out of their palace.
I see. So blocked is worse than unfollowed.
Yeah.
It's a deliberate poke in the eye.
I think mute is worse, because then the person doesn't know that you can't see them. They think that you're still they're still talking at you, but you've muted them, so they're just wasting their breath.
Yeah, that mute is something else. Well, Dave, this is how you can look at it: the unfollow and blocked. You can look at it like, man, you got fired, or oh, okay, you got let go.
I see.
You see the difference in that?
So you got fired.
I got fired. I got fired from Brett Favre. But it's cool. Here's the thing. I didn't accuse him of anything. I was asking. Like when you start talking about the example because of the money you make, so you want to open up that can by saying, hey, we make a lot of money, we need to do things a certain way. You made a lot of money. Should you be sending text messages of your you-know-what to reporters when you're married, bro?
It is communication, I guess.
So that's like saying, you mean the virus was deliberately released by China? Question mark?
Yes.
Is that how it is?
You're out of liability because of that question mark.
G. Scott, 9 o'clock with G and Ursula on Cairo Radio. Thank you, G.
All right.
This is Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien. A new law is clearing the way for more than 100 Washington inmates serving life without parole to seek early release. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott reports.
In the last 2 weeks, Washington has seen two inmates serving life without parole under the so-called three strikes law get resentenced and released from prison under a new law the prosecutors say was long overdue to fix a broken system that left dozens of people, mostly people of color, to rot in our prisons for crimes that don't match the time.
Last year, you did an important thing by taking robbery 2 off of the list of persistent offenses. That's something I've always advocated. It's the lowest crime on that list of persistent offenses. It's the most common, and it's the most racially disproportionate.
King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg earlier this year, as he urged the legislature to pass a bill, Democratic sponsor and Senator Jeannie Darnielle explained, was necessary to ensure more than 100 people aren't left to die in prison for the crime of second-degree robbery, which had been considered a strike until lawmakers removed it from the list of strikeable offenses. The problem, Darnielle explained, was that they did not make that law retroactive.
The focus here is on giving prosecutors the tools they need to do that, to be fair in our approach and go back and apply this law retroactively, to recognize that we have great racial disproportionality in the persons that are impacted by having not made this law retroactive 2 years ago. 46% of those persons are Black. Additionally, 45% are over the age of 55, so unlikely to have more criminal activity.
Freddie served 24 years under the three strikes law, including for second-degree robbery. And the law won't help him because he was already released under clemency. And just a few weeks ago, he told lawmakers things were looking up.
I'm doing good. I've been out
what, a little over a month, and I've gotten a job. I have my vehicle. I got my driver's license. I have insurance on my vehicle. I'm doing pretty good. So I came out with the mentality of I can't stop progressing. And as long as you keep that mentality, you'll be okay. But you have some who fall off, but you can't look at them and judge everybody else.
As that bill was being debated this past session, the word was that there was about 50 of these inmates who were serving life without parole under the three strikes law because they had at least one second-degree robbery that needed to be resentenced. Now that number has grown to 114 and counting. So 114 other inmates in the state now have that shot at freedom because of Darnielle's bill, which passed to make the removal of second-degree robbery retroactive.
This bill requires that they are resentenced, and it requires the prosecutor to review all the sentencing documents. If the person qualifies, the prosecutor has the duty to move to resentence that person. And the court determines whether they're going to grant the...
Carla Lee is deputy chief of staff at the King County Prosecutor's Office and has now been able to get the first two inmates of that 114 resentenced under the retroactive law. The first resentencing on May 28th.
That was a little bit of an emergency, and it was because the gentleman had received notice from his doctor that he only had so much time to live. We decided instead of going through our normal process that we would expedite that one.
That was a special circumstance. Then last week, Russell Harvey, a 60-year-old man who served nearly a quarter century of his life without parole sentence for second-degree robberies, got his shot at resentencing, first reading an emotional statement to the court that Lee explained.
It was a tearjerker. He had everyone in the courtroom tearing up because of just the story that he shared, which was a statement that he had also included in his court materials, his filed materials with the court, just expressing just, you know, the hardship of having gone through prison, having had a hard life, and disappointing his mom. That was something that was really heartbreaking for him, is that he felt like he was a disappointment to his mother.
Sadly, Harvey's mother passed away earlier this year, just before he was released from prison. Prosecutors and supporters of the change to make this retroactive say it's important to realize that not everyone will be released under this resentencing. The three strikes law that was passed in Washington state by the voters includes strikable offenses like murder, rape, serious assault, and very violent crimes, whereas second-degree robbery is a much different crime.
The second-degree robbery is an individual who goes into an establishment and via intimidation or threatens to take or does take property from another person. In some instances, if they were to use a weapon, it would become a robbery in the first degree. In these cases, oftentimes, it's just the threat and the taking of the property. Sometimes they may act as if they have something in their hand, or they may share a note asking the cashier to provide everything that she has. Oftentimes, we just go into a grocery store asking for the cash, maybe taking some other items and then leaving.
When this bill originally came up a couple of years ago, it did not have the support of the Washington Association of Prosecutors. This time around, it did.
That is Hannah Scott.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.